The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last year, an online survey confirmed a sad truth about our listening habits, that people over the age of 33 effectively stop discovering new music and are doomed to recycle the hits of their youth. We found that so hard to believe. After all, so many people talk about the important role that music plays in their lives. So we sent producer Molly Donahue around our office to see what NHPR staffers had to say about their musical habits.
So how old are you?
I'm 36 years old.
25.
33.
I am 39 years old.
I'm 24.
Okay, and then when is the last time you bought or got into new music?
That's a good question.
Gosh.
Last time I bought music was online.
A few months ago, maybe in the summer or last summer, a Mahalia Jackson record.
Well, new music for me is old music.
I've gone the last couple of years. I've gone a few times to the broadcast of the Met Opera they do. Got new music. I mean, new to me.
I hope where you're going with this is the fact that, like, my identity was, like, getting into new artists for, like, my entire youth up until I went to college. Like, I don't know what happened.
There you go, our thoroughly unscientific sampling of the NHPR staff on how they discover, or rather don't discover, new music. Gabe Moline rejects the notion that age prevents us from getting our groove on. He's music editor at KQED Arts in California, and last year he celebrated a milestone by writing an essay called Keep Listening, Notes on Turning 40 and Still Seeking Out New Music. So is this borne out by people you know, that research that people pretty much stop discovering new music after 30-something?
Well, anecdotally, you can see it all over the place in, you know, middle-aged people wearing Ramones t-shirts or, you know, AC/DC shirts. But there was a recent study, actually, earlier this year that determined through, I believe, Spotify data that people really stopped seeking out new music by the age of 33 and just listened to the music they liked in high school or the music they liked in college. And that was incredibly depressing to me.
Well, why do you think we stop or people stop?
I don't know. Music for a lot of people is a nostalgic thing connected to their youth. Like I say in this piece, I remember my mom telling me once that the music you like in high school is going to be your favorite music for the rest of your life.
Oh, my goodness.
And with this study, it boggled my mind because 33 was about the time that I started not wanting to listen to any music that I'd heard before and became really ravenous and exploratory for new sounds.
Part of your advice is to continue interacting with music in a very tangible way. So how do you mean?
Well, the obvious one, and it's almost a cliche these days, but purchase physical media. It really makes a difference when you have something tactile in your hands, when you have artwork and liner notes, and when you yourself lift your hand to push a button or drop a needle on music.
All right, so buy music, actual music. What else? How should we interact with new music?
Well, live music is really just a no-brainer. I can't tell you how many times my reaction to a piece of music has changed by seeing it performed live. Usually for the better, you know, sometimes for the worse. Also, you're in a room with, 500, 8,000, maybe 20,000 people. And you're sharing that just communal joy with so many people, which is, there's just nothing like it.
Well, I really love that idea. I think it's so important to kind of be with live music. But it goes against what everybody says about, you know, once you're in your 30s, you probably have kids. It's harder to go out and see music. Then when you go, you feel like the old guy at the club. Does that happen to you?
Oh, yeah. You know, you have to constantly banish that worry that you're the old person at the show. You know, I still go to a lot of rap shows where I'm very much the oldest person there. I go to, you know, punk shows. I go to warehouse shows. It's not my scene, according to the rules, but I don't know. When has music ever played by the rules? I think if you're there and you're passionate about it and maybe you know at least one or two other people there, it helps. But, you know, it's also kind of neat to be the outsider. It's also kind of neat to be the fly on the wall. You know, that's how it was when I first started going to concerts, and it was terrifying. But I learned from it.
Did you once have a more adventurous and intimate relationship with music, feeling like you don't know where to find new artists? Well, Gabe Moline is with us. He's music editor at KQED Arts, and he's giving us some tips on how to keep discovering new music after 40. So going to see live bands, putting yourself out there, buying physical copies of music, I understand, you know, why that really works. But they don't necessarily push you to try new music. You could just buy, you know, the same old copies. You could go to see the same old bands. How do you suggest people actually find the new music?
My experience is, you know, it really kind of comes from the crate digging world, you know, looking through piles of records at record stores, at thrift stores, at junk stores, and just looking for something that catches my eye rather than my ear. But you can also make commitments. I mean, there are a number of very stupid ways that I make sure that I still like new music. And one of them is to commit to listening to one style of music that you hate for a week, solid. And, you know, something really strange and beautiful happens when you do that. You know, you may come out of it hating that style of music even more, or what's happened with me almost always is to have a new appreciation of it.
I'm curious of what you tried.
Well, in this piece, I mentioned the week that I listened solely to pop country radio. And my goodness, so much of, you know, new modern pop country is very corny. Some of it is really poignant and really emotional. And my main takeaway from that week is that country music is impeccably crafted. You know, country music is one of the last genres of music in America that employs songwriters full time. There's something just really unique and cool about people striving to write a hit all day long, and sometimes succeeding.
When I was in high school and middle school, actually, I had a group of friends. They were constantly passing around music. So how do you suggest that we maintain that kind of social aspect of music appreciation once you turn 40 and your peer groups are somewhat more constricted and somewhat less, you know, we can't sit around and make mixtapes anymore?
Yeah. You could if you wanted to, but you'd find a small audience among your friends who might be able to play them. I think the best way to share music is in person. You might make a weekly night where you invite friends over and everyone has to bring two songs, and you go around and you listen to everyone's two songs. Not everyone can make that type of commitment, but all the beautiful things need work at some point. You know, after 12 years of marriage, you realize we need to work to keep nurturing this. Children are beautiful things, and they require a lot of work, especially in their teenage years. And your relationship with music is the same. And at some point, you'll realize that it might be slowly slipping away from you. And if you catch it at the right time, and you make a commitment to keep that relationship alive, you'll be in good hands.
Well, Gabe, thank you very much for sharing your musical philosophy with us.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Gabe Moline is music editor at KQED Arts in California, and there's a link to read his article, Keep Listening, Notes on Turning 40 and Still Seeking Out New Music, at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In some families, discussing feelings is taboo, never mind probing mental health issues. But things are different in the House family. Jeff and Tenley's relationship is not your everyday father and daughter bond. In their case, depression has brought them closer together.
When Jeff House was a teenager, he couldn't get enough of The Who. They were his favorite band, by far. The Who were his escape from depression, especially the song Love Reign Over Me.
There's a rock opera called Quadrophenia, where there's a teenage boy who's the hero of the story, and he's questioning whether or not he should exist. Rock opera's the events leading up to the boy contemplating suicide, and it's just amazing to me. It's something I just love, which is why I'm a fan of that band.
Only love can make it rain.
Jeff says he grew up hating himself. He hated himself so much that, at the age of 16, he tried to take his own life. He hated himself so much that, when he survived, he said to himself, "You screw everything up, and now you've screwed this up too." For years, no one knew he had attempted suicide. No one asked, and he didn't tell.
My parents did not want to utter the word suicide. They didn't want to hear the word suicide. Again, this was 1980, and that was a dirty word in the place where we were in the rural area. They were very church-going Christians, and you just didn't say suicide.
Jeff says he managed to repress the memory of his suicide attempt, but his self-loathing continued. In fact, he hated himself so much, he was determined not to have kids.
When I was a very young man, did not want to have children, largely because I didn't want to pass that gene along that could potentially lead to another person feeling that way.
That's good. Mm-hmm.
Today, 35 years later, Jeff still struggles with depression, but he knows how to keep it under control. He's married, has a nice home in Plymouth, works as a data analyst, and though he never, ever thought it would happen, he's a dad.
I told you to come down and burn your mouth.
Yeah, I did that. You're welcome.
Thanks. He has two teenage children. He says it was his wife, Melanie, who turned him around.
Being in a sustained, long-term, loving marriage, it helped my self-esteem, and it helped me be comfortable with wanting to be a parent, bring a child into the world.
They are a close family. They travel, they cook together, and crack jokes about each other. They seem to have fun. It's a life Jeff would have never predicted. But one prediction did come true.
When my daughter started to exhibiting these mood swings, I was more scared than other people around us.
I was really angry when I was 13, 14, and you know, a lot of people are angry when they're 13, 14, 15.
That's Stanley, Jeff's 18-year-old daughter.
Politics and, you know, people at school being jerks, you know, and that just, like, made me so exhausted.
As she got older, the mood swings got more extreme. And it was very scary.
And that made me think, like, God, I'm so tired of feeling like this. I just want to die. And that played a big part in, you know, finally having that breakdown and, like, becoming pretty close to suicide. So, yeah.
Tenley eventually confessed to her therapist she had a plan to take her own life. In response, Jeff and Melanie pulled her out of school and put her in a hospital for 2 weeks. They were terrified. Jeff thought she was just like him. But he chose to do the opposite of what his parents did.
When it came out that she had been thinking about suicide, I told her that if she died, that it would ruin me, that it would kick my ass, and it would kick her brother's ass, and it would kick my wife's ass. And I don't know, that seemed to really get her when I told her that.
That conversation with Danley was just the beginning. They talk about it at lunch. They talk about it at dinner. And there's a suicide hotline magnet on the fridge. Danley says her father even makes jokes about it as a defense mechanism.
In our house, I walk around with clothes that have suicide prevention on them, and we go to suicide events, and I have a suicide interview going on right now in my home. So I want my daughter to be able to say what she's thinking in with something that dangerous. So we make it just a part of the vocabulary.
How do you notice on each other that you are more depressed than usually?
You get easily irritated. You get snippy. And you withdraw.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
You, Tenley, get easily irritated and you withdraw.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing.
It's very clear that the two of them are close. It's strange to think that their depression has made Jeff and Tenley this close. But it has. And music has, too. Like the band The Who, Tenley and Jeff had always listened to The Who together. But Jeff never told her about Love Reign Over Me, about how important it is to him.
It's a prayer to God for connection to the universe and to other people. It's a beautiful song. When you're feeling isolated and you feel like the world is doesn't need you anymore and you're worthless, when you have connections with other people, you think people want you around, then you're less likely to want to leave the earth. We saw them perform Quadrophenia in Boston 2 years ago. That was a really big deal.
That drive up there, you were just talking about how much it meant to you, and I didn't know that all until then.
Did you know at that point that I had attempted suicide?
Yes.
I don't think I'd said it directly, but I hinted around it for a while.
Mm-hmm. I figured that out.
So I think that night was the night I said it explicitly, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was.
Okay.
You're right.
So we went to a bar before the show.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the first time you'd been in a bar?
Probably not.
No? Yeah, that was a big deal for me to show that part of myself. And
yeah, I got that feeling.
Expose that.
Yeah, I definitely got that feeling.
Did we both cry or just you?
Pretty sure we both cried.
We did?
Yeah.
Jeff and Tenley realized how connection can save someone's life. Because of that, they have become advocates for suicide prevention. Jeff volunteers with the Samaritans, a suicide prevention group on Cape Cod. He runs an 8-week support program for people who have attempted suicide. Tenley admires the work her father does and hopes to become more involved, like him. For now, she helps her friends that are struggling with depression.
In the moment when I'm listening to one of my friends talk and they're saying that they are feeling horrible and saying things that like really strikes a chord with me, talking about how depressed they are or whatever, like in that moment, I'm like, yeah, cool. Like I know exactly what they're talking about and I know exactly what to do. And that's like a really great feeling.
The connection to her dad and her friends seems to make her healthier. Tenley takes medication for depression, and she sees a therapist regularly. For the moment, all is well.
Do you think about having kids yourself?
No, I don't think about having kids partly because of the genetic thing. There's too much that I don't want to risk passing on.
But that's the distant future. In the near future, she's going to college. She got accepted into Massachusetts College of Art and Design, which means she'll move to Boston in September. It will be a big step for Tenley and Jeff.
I'm very excited about it. There's an element of fear too. Like, what do you think it's going to be like when you're?
Sometimes I think it's going to eat me alive, and sometimes I think I'm just going to be okay. But all the time is don't know.
And I don't know means sometimes
terror. That's yeah. So I don't know. It's always terror, really. It's like.
Really? It's never like this could be really awesome. It's never that.
Yeah, but it's always just like still scared. Hesitantly optimistic and also scared.
But every once in a while you get that turns over. Maybe going to school will be, you know, a little like that will be.
A little like
you pretty walk much in terrified and then you loosen up.
As like as pretty time. Much every other nerve-wracking experience.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Before Tanley goes off to college, there's one more thing she and her father need to do. They're going to New York to see The Who. Love.
And that story was produced by Katarina Marchines at the Transom Story Workshop. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Anybody can sound off on the internet. It is much harder to share your opinions or talk about what's plaguing you in person. For artist, actor, filmmaker, and radio producer Sukhyun Lee, that real-life discourse is the stuff of a sleepover.
I invite three strangers to share a hotel room with me for one night. Each stranger arrives with a specific problem they need help with. And then over the next 24 hours, we hash it out and get to know one another while stuck in one room.
Sleepover is a CBC radio show and podcast that invites listeners into the unrehearsed and unpredictable encounters that can only happen when strangers are thrown together face-to-face in a limited space for a limited time. Our guest is host and orchestrator of The Sleepover, Sukhyun Lee. Sukhyun, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here, Virginia.
So this is one of those, this is crazy, this is brilliant. ideas. There are so many ways to put people together to talk. Why a sleepover?
Well, there's kind of affectionate feeling, you know, like every kid, I had sleepovers when I was a kid and very fond of those memories of dragging a sleeping bag out. And, you know, I'm a big fan of pillow talk. I really love that. I could do that forever. And that notion of, you know, bringing in very diverse and different people in to share a space. I mean, I think that sort of begins in a kind of open and friendly place. And then we get to the tough stuff.
Are there any rules in this container of a hotel room? I mean, can people come and go? Are there any ways, like language you shouldn't use? Any shoulds or shouldn'ts?
Well, generally speaking, you know, there's an agreement. No one's being forced into this situation. Everyone has been approached. I've, you know, found very amazing and intriguing people that I know kind of are very different from one another. I want to see how they're going to collide and clash with one another. There's an essential agreement to share space and create space. So there's a kind of like understanding that what we create together. Other than that, I haven't encountered anyone having to, you know, run out of the hotel yet or take a smoke break, thank goodness. But we essentially create this very intense 24-hour experience, a kind of leap of faith to be together and create conversation and connection.
There have been three episodes at the time that we're speaking to you based on one encounter, 24 hours. There are these three distinct half-hour episodes based on each of the three strangers. Here's just a clip of you introducing them.
First of all, I want to thank you for taking a giant leap of faith with me. Over the next 20 hours or so, we're going to be asking each other all kinds of nosy questions. Are you ready?
Yes.
As ready as I can be.
What is nosy?
That last one adorably asking what nosy means is Charlie McGettigan. She's 8 years old. We also heard from Sachi Cole. She's a social media maven, writes for BuzzFeed Canada. And Alan Zweig. Am I saying that right?
Alan Zweig.
Zweig. He's 64. He warns them all he snores rather loudly. All three have to have a problem to be solved and be willing to submit to this 24-hour experiment. How are they chosen?
Well, you know, in very many different ways. So, say, for example, Charlie, I know from my neighborhood, she's an extremely dynamic and precocious 8-year-old girl. Her mom's a Romanian dancer. Her dad's a Newfoundland rocker. Charlie is her unique own being and lots of energy and intelligence. Love her so much. I also wanted to include a range of people, ages, careers, viewpoints, beliefs, religions, right across, because I find that many times, you know, in this day and age, we kind of are so separated and oftentimes communicate virtually. So, or technology mediates our correspondence. So really trying to put individuals together who would never find themselves in a room together in the first place. So she was on the list, and then trying to figure out who would kind of tangentially be interesting to sort of collide with her. And Alan Zweig, as you say, he's a senior citizen. He's also a documentary filmmaker. Alan is a curmudgeon. He's a big grumpy pants. I mean, I saw him through my Facebook feed. I was like, who is this guy? He's so grumpy. He's always so kind of complaining about stuff, but in a kind of like those two guys that would be in the balcony on the Muppet Show, those guys. So I was like, okay, I got to get a grouch, Mr. Grouchy in there. Alan's interesting too, because, you know, most of his life he's felt like a big loser. And it's only recently that his career has taken off, that he actually found a woman who fell in love with him, and together they had a child. So he calls himself an old dad. He's a senior, but his daughter, she's like 5 years old. So, you know, he has complications where he picks up his daughter from school, and he can feel all the other kids looking at her saying, who's the old guy with the big belly picking her up? So he's very upfront about these things. You know, I think a big part of it is finding people who, A, have difficulties in their lives, which is everyone, but also people willing to speak of them candidly. And then there was Sachi Cole, who is a very interesting and opinionated woman. She's a writer and also a big online presence through social media. She's very politically minded, and she often calls out what she feels is injustices, specifically to do with privilege and race and socioeconomic injustices. And she's, you know, I wanted to see what she would be like with Alan in that same room, because in a lot of ways, on paper, you would think that they would have very oppositional perspectives. And I wanted to see, especially in a time where, you know, so much of our conversation sort of devolve into a kind of large fight where opposing sides say incendiary remarks to each other and then quickly go offline. I wanted to see what would happen if we contained people with very, very different opinions in the same space. What would be the common factors and what would be the differences, and could they work differences out?
Well, it strikes me when I was thinking, what could I do this, that we are so often in our own sort of bubbles of comfortable camaraderie, people who know and speak and think about the same kind of things that we speak about. It takes some courage, I think, on the part of your guests to be willing to submit themselves to this.
It takes a great, great deal of courage. And every time we do a sleepover, I am overwhelmed and inspired by the willingness, the bravery to be in that room together. I think, you know, at first when we came up with this notion, you know, it really was a response to the kind of devolution of communication and kind of face-to-face time that I'm seeing happening in our world today. And it's utterly imperative that we do have that time that we can be together. And I think that notion is so connecting with people. So when I reach out to people and explain what the intention is, many of them feel the same way. And so that is why, you know, at first we were like, who's going to agree to this? This is an intense durational experience. And yet I was so surprised and heartened to see people really embrace this idea.
Here's a clip from the second episode. This one was focused on Sachi, who tells us she's a brown woman, she has a brown father, and her problem actually is that he shows his disapproval for her by giving her the silent treatment, refusing to communicate. But what we're going to hear is a part of reaction to something Alan said about, you know, he expected when he got there that other people would look like him, which she calls him out on for being, you know, sort of entitled white man expecting everyone to look like him. Let's hear.
that's, I think, where this debate gets derailed, which is that when people talk like that, people in the majority take it as a criticism and not merely just a statement of what is true, that because you're in the majority, you do get the privilege to walk into a room and expect that there's going to be a lot of people like you. But I'm not saying that you have to hang yourself because you're like a white dude here, but...
I didn't say people like me. I mean, maybe I said, but I didn't mean people like me because I don't relate to the world as being filled with people like me, whatever.
Okay.
That's a clip from The Sleepover, a radio show and podcast that throws three strangers with a problem into a hotel room to help each other out. And our guest is Sukyun Lee, the host and co-producer of The Sleepover. Sukyun, what was going on there?
Yeah, so this was, a conversation that spilled out, and suddenly there was an electricity in the room, a tension. We heard there, there's Alan. You know, he says that he suffers from foot and mouth disease. He's quite aware that Sachi has convictions. She has strong feelings about white male privilege, and there he is, having expressed the assumption that he would walk into a room and see three white guys just like him, and she really wanted to tell him that as a Indo-Canadian woman, she would never be able to assume that kind of thing. But she doesn't
shoot him down, which I think is great. She doesn't say,
he gets his back up and he wants to walk away. And what is extraordinary, if you listen to where it goes further in the podcast, seemingly opposing viewpoints come together. What happens is, as we get to know one another, despite their seemingly opposing perspectives, Sachi and Alan find incredible similarities. They're both extremely blunt. They speak their minds. They come from very similar families with incredible pressures, very funny individuals. And suddenly we're realizing that they're kind of the same person, but in different bodies. A 25-year-old Indo-Canadian woman and a 65-year-old old dad Jewish grumpy guy. In this kind of situation, the differences are explored. And normally, if this was taking place online, it would have spiraled out into this kind of big...
insults and name-calling.
Name-calling, blocking people. When we're all in a room, you cannot escape. You are there, and we want to see what the extra layer is. Everyone is walking around with convictions and assumptions. And as you say, most of us, even in our friend circle online, we talk to other people that reaffirm our viewpoint. It is so seldom that we walk out of our own comfort zones to see what another person can offer.
Well, there they are in this room together. It's getting messy increasingly. There's wet bathing suits, empty coffee cups, pizza boxes. But this could easily veer into that, the kind of reality TV construct of highlighting or even creating tension for tension's sake. So how do you avoid that as a producer?
Yeah, that's a total, that is one intention. I make it very clear that there is no winner or loser in this. There is no competitive aspect to this. This is not just for, entertainment. This is to actually try to facilitate really important conversations that can bring us together. So the whole ethos of the show is that of humanism and that of curiosity and that of playfulness and that of coming together. So it is completely devoid of the kind of, wrestling match, mudslinging, contrived conflicts. I think the fact that there is no competitive aspect of it really helps people, once they understand that this is not this sort of tacky, terrible entertainment situation. They want to be there.
Thank you so much for letting us spy a little bit on The Sleepover.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Sukyun Lee is host and co-producer of The Sleepover radio show and podcast, which throws strangers together in a hotel room for 24 hours to see if they can forge meaningful connections. There's a link to the trailer for the show on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.